Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. What were some of your childhood dreams?
Ever since I was a kid imitating Flyboy's zombie walk from George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, I've spent countless hours thinking about getting to be a zombie in a movie or TV show. I was going to be a walker in an episode on the fifth season of The Walking Dead.
Wow, that must have been amazing.
I wasn't just excited about this gig, I was losing my mind. And I'd be working with effects master Greg Nicotero. Greg had me crawl further out of my crap pile and had the visual effects guy come onto the set to tell me what I needed to do to die like a real Walking Dead walker. What was it like to be on The Walking Dead? It was the best ever.
Today on Storyworthy, guitarist, author, and co-founder of the metal band Anthrax, Scott Ian, talks about fulfilling his dream of being a zombie on The Walking Dead. Stick around.
Hey, it's Scott Ian, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Topanga Canyon, California. I'm so glad you guys tuned in today, whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener. Welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys had a chance to enjoy the story last week with storyteller Christopher Rivas and his story, Kleptomaniac. This story, you guys, was off the hook. I mean, it wasn't just like about stealing, like, you know, little stuff like I stole that hamster from Woolworths. Not that. I mean, this guy was full-on kleptomaniac. He stole everything. And it's just a fascinating tale of how he got through that and how he didn't go to prison. Anyway, super interesting. So go back and listen to that, but not now, because today you guys are tuned in for a really interesting episode. I'm talking with Scott Ian, the rhythm guitarist and co-founder of the band Anthrax, who is not only, you guys, as you know, a legendary musician and a very important person in the world of music, but he's also an author and a public speaker. And this makes me think how interesting it is that, like, comedians that I know, they kind of want to be rock stars. There's something about what a comedian does and what a rock star does, and they're very similar. So here we have Scott Ian, who, you know, not only spends his life and his world in music and on stage and touring, but then he turns around and he writes books and he does public speaking. And I think he might want to be a famous comedian. I'm not sure about that. But he just wrote a book and I'm so excited to talk with him about it. It's called Access All Areas, Stories from a Hard Rock Life. And as you can imagine, it's been a hard rock life, I believe. And Scott brings forth the topic, My Life as a Zombie, which has to do with him being on The Walking Dead. So this is like random. I'm not exactly sure where it's all coming from, and I'm excited to hear about it. This book, it just came out December 12th. It's a brand new book. I believe this is dropping December 11th, so I haven't even read it yet, and I haven't seen this story. So I'm thrilled that Scott is here, and he's going to read it for us. I do remember Scott and you guys being on Anthrax was on Married with Children. I remember that in the early 90s.
Yes.
That was like a cameo.
Yeah, a pretty big cameo. We were, I guess you could say we were guest stars.
You were guest stars did you hook up with Kelly Bundy in that or didn't happen?
Oh, I have that story in the book too.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's in here for real. That story is in here.
Tell me something about that.
That's the question, one of the questions I get asked the most since 1992. Did I or anyone have sex with Kelly Bundy? And the story in this book answers that question, as well as how weird that question is, because Kelly Bundy's not real.
Right, of course. It's Christina Applegate.
I go deep into the many levels of how weird that question actually is. I can't just answer it. I have to examine it.
That's really, really funny. It's just that show was so iconic, and every one of those characters was so specific.
Sure.
It's like saying Henry Winkler instead of Fonzie.
Yeah.
I mean, you would just say Fonzie.
Right.
Because it's that, you know, specific. But that's very funny, and I don't even know why I knew that. That just pulled that right out of my quiver.
People still ask all the time.
Okay, so today we're going to hear about you on The Walking Dead. But before we get to Scott's story, you guys, I wanted to remind you to head over to my website, storyworthypodcast.com, and join my mailing list. you know, I write to you on Monday. We get along. We're friends. That's all. I'm not bothering you. We're just, you know, we're pals. That would be nice, right? Would you like to do that with me? Yes? Yes. And don't forget to subscribe to Storyworthy on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. All right, you guys, he's here right now, Scott Ian. He is the rhythm guitarist and co-founder of Anthrax, like I mentioned. And for anybody in my audience who is not aware of this premier thrash metal band, I mean, one of the best of all time, Anthrax has released 11 studio albums, 5 live albums, 7 compilation albums, 10 video albums, 6 extended plays, 26 singles, 26 music videos.
Have we?
Yes, and you guys don't stop. As you know, Scott, you're on your way out for the Killthrax tour in 2018 with so many dates. I mean, it's just phenomenal. You guys do not stop, and it's just such an exciting career that you've led. And like I said, you guys, Scott's also the author, and his latest book, Access All Areas, Stories from a Hard Rock Life, is what we're going to talk about today. But he has also written another book, and that was called I'm the Man, the story of that guy from Anthrax, and that was an autobiography. I love the title. Right to the point.
Thanks.
I'm the man. Anyway, Scott, he just has so many great stories, and we are so excited he's here with us today. You can follow Scott on Twitter at Scott_Ian and head over to his website at scott-ian.com, where you also, by the way, have some fabulous photos. I love the photos of Anthrax, like the crowd shots.
Cool.
Because it just shows what is going on in that room. The power.
Yeah, the energy.
The energy, the spirit is just phenomenal. That music, I'm telling you, you know, I didn't necessarily, you know, have that in my life, but in the last few days I've been listening to a lot of it. And the music just moves you. Like it's, and not with volume, but with like the power. So I'm just super impressed and I'm glad you're here. And you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for the one and only Scott Ian.
The Walking Dead, My Life as a Zombie. Okay, so Andrew is going to be fighting the walkers, and they are going to back him up to right in front of where you are laying under the garbage. As soon as he is within your reach, I want you to lunge out with your hand and grab his leg. And I mean really grab it, as hard as you can, and don't let go until he rips his leg out of your hand. Got it? Then you start crawling out, okay? I was trying hard to listen to director/executive producer/effects legend/metalhead/friend Greg Nicotero give me direction for my scene with Rick, played by Andrew Lincoln, and Carl, played by Chandler Riggs. I really was trying to pay attention. The last thing I wanted to do was screw up and have the whole production waiting on Greg's friend to get it right. My comprehension issue stemmed from it being very hard for me to get past the idea that I was actually in The Walking Dead. In it! I was lying under a pile of garbage, made up as a walker, about to attack the main character of the show. This was truly the biggest who-the-hell-let-me-in-here moment of my life. Ever since I was a kid imitating Flyboy's zombie walk from George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, I've spent countless hours thinking about getting to be a zombie in a movie or TV show. Dream big, kids. It pays off. My path to zombiedom was a long one. You don't just get made up by an effects guy and bam, you're a zombie. No. It takes a lot of hard work and disappointment, and ultimately it's your love for the genre that will allow you to triumph and represent the undead. The Walking Dead premiered on Halloween 2010, and it quickly tapped into a heretofore unknown vein, the mainstream's love of zombies. Who knew? I don't need to tell the story of how a horror genre-specific show based on a comic book became the biggest show on television. All of that is well documented and written about by actual television writers. This story is about how a zombie-obsessed nerd became one. Not long after The Walking Dead took a big bite out of our TV-watching habits, I got a call from my agent asking when I'd be in New York City because there was a show being put together, some kind of, quote, talk show about zombies, and the producers wanted to see me. It just so happened I was in New York City, and I was intrigued. A talk show about zombies? I could do that all day. Shit, I already did that all day, and no one was paying me for it. The next day, I spoke to a producer who told me that the idea for the show was a Walking Dead post-show. They wanted a couple of guys sitting around talking about the episode they just watched. I thought he was kidding. "That's a show?" I asked him. I wasn't being a jerk about it. I was genuinely curious. He told me they had Chris Hardwick as the host, and my role would be zombie expert and field reporter. He also told me to not talk about this with anyone. It was top secret. I was trying to visualize the show in my brain, like a football post show where the hosts discuss the game and give replays of the best plays. Like if Chris and I watched Dawn of the Dead and then broke it down afterward. "What a movie, Chris! Let's see that helicopter blade cut through the zombie's head again in slow motion." "Oh yeah, Scott, that was awesome. And how about that biker who just had to have his blood pressure taken right in the middle of the mall, surrounded by zombies? What the hell was he thinking? Let's take another look and see where he went wrong." Was there really an audience for that? I couldn't believe we were having this conversation. An actual TV producer was telling me he wanted me to be a zombie field reporter on a pilot episode for a not-yet-titled Walking Dead post-show. That's a dream job I couldn't have conjured myself, even in my wildest fantasies. And I was already friends with Chris from way back in the 90s when I first saw him doing stand-up comedy in Los Angeles, so that made it even better. I told the producer I'd love to be on that show, and when and where did they want me? A couple of days later, I was on the set of Andy Cohen's Watch What Happens Live show, watching some stagehands redecorate Andy's set with some horror accoutrement, zombifying it. Chris and I talked to the producers, who ran us through what we'd be doing. It couldn't have been easier. We talked about the episode we had just watched and speculated on the characters' fates. Chris introduced my field segment, and I talked about that, even though it hadn't been shot yet, and we basically nerded out for 30 minutes. The producers said it went great, and we all went out for food and drinks. Easy peasy. Chris and I were all smiles as we talked about the idea of doing this show. It was really too good to be true. My field reporter segment was going to be filmed the following week in Los Angeles, where Greg Nicotero was directing the first Walking Dead webisodes about the life of the Bicycle Girl zombie, the crawling torso zombie that Rick puts out of her misery in episode 1, season 1. The webisodes were going to be her backstory. My job was to report from the set, show how things are done, and get made up to be a walker. Yeah, I know, tough job. I wasn't just excited about this gig, I was losing my mind. And I'd be working with effects master Greg Nicotero, co-founder of the KNB Effects Group. The man is a fucking legend. It'd be easier to list the movies he hasn't worked on. I knew Greg from the late 1980s. We had met through our mutual friend and horror nerd, Kirk Hammett. We had one night out in particular that bonded us as lifelong friends in the early 1990s. Kirk was staying at the Chateau Marmont in Bungalow 3. That's the bungalow where John Belushi died. Kirk, Greg, my friend Rich, and I got very drunk that night, and when we got back to the bungalow, we decided we'd go on a hunt for Belushi's ghost. Yep, we were that drunk. First, we had to get back into the bungalow, as Kirk had lost his key, and we were all too drunk to find our way back to the front desk through the dark, labyrinth-like grounds of the chateau. Rich fixed that problem by punching his hand through a pane of glass in the door and reaching in and opening it from the inside. I still don't know how he didn't cut the shit out of himself. Maybe Belushi's spirit was watching over us and enjoying the mayhem. We started searching the bungalow for signs of I don't even know what. Anything that seemed to evoke Belushi. This was at least 10 years after he had died, and the place had obviously been cleaned thousands of times. But in our compromised states, we weren't thinking clearly. Mostly, we were all just giggling and stumbling around. Greg, at least I think it was Greg, found a door that led to a space underneath the bungalow. Jackpot! We found a flashlight. I have no idea where we found a flashlight. And all of us headed through the mystery door and down the steps into the basement. There was a dirt floor and some trash littered throughout the space. I found an old Budweiser can, and that's all we needed. It was 100% absolutely Belushi's old beer can. We had proof! I was yelling, "It's proof! It's proof!" Proof of what? I have no idea now. But in that musty, dark basement, it meant everything in the moment.
I was holding it up over my head triumphantly as we all ran back up the stairs yelling that we found it. Short attention span drinkers that we were onto something else pretty much right after we found the beer can. We'd make really shitty ghost hunters. Back to the zombie post show. I got to the set of the webisodes and was immediately sent to the makeup trailer to start the process of transforming me into a walker. I met Garrett Immel from K&B, and he explained how they had already made some of the pieces they would put on my face just using photos of me as reference, which would speed up the process a little bit. He wasn't starting from scratch and had a good idea of what he wanted to do to my face, walker-wise. Usually they would use a life cast of the actor's head to make the pieces, but I had not had one of those done yet. Even with some of the pieces already made, it still took about 3.5 hours to glue all the pieces on and paint them. I loved every minute of it. I didn't want Garrett to finish. I've read about actors who hate having to spend so much time getting made up for a role, as well as actors who love it and totally go with it. And they're getting paid millions to do it. I would show up and do this for free just because it was that much fun. Seriously, if I could get made up by K&B every day, I would. Looking in the mirror and seeing a different face looking back at me was awesome. It felt liberating. Any nerves I had about having to act disappeared into my new face. My only issue was that my eyes were still my eyes, distracting from the brilliant job Garrett had done. I told him my eyes made my new walker face just look like my old face. He told me not to worry. Once I had the contact lenses in, that would all change. But I was worried about the contact lenses. I'd never had lenses in before this, and like most people, I'm sensitive to stuff getting put into my eyes. I met with the lens expert. She calmly talked me down off the ledge. If she could put lenses in Johnny Depp's eyes, she was his personal lens person. I guess I could trust her. I sucked it up and did my best to relax. Unlike getting the makeup on my face, having the lenses put in was not enjoyable. It took multiple attempts on each eye, mainly because I was so nervous. I could barely deal with the eye drops she used to lubricate my eyeballs before the lenses were put in. Then she's telling me to look up and off to one side, and I'm sweating and trying to breathe through it, and there's a finger in my eye, and the lens feels giant and weird, and then it's in and she tells me to close my eye and move it around. I could feel the lens, no pain, just the size of it. The lenses she made for me were almost opaque and are larger than the everyday contacts people wear. She told me to open my eye, and I could barely see. And that was just my left eye. I still had an eye to go. The second lens was a little easier, as I knew what it'd feel like. With both lenses in, I really couldn't see. I had a production assistant who was supposed to help me walk around set, but that made me feel lame, so I walked very slowly and deliberately. The lenses were helping me get into walker mode. Method acting. And they looked great. The discomfort had been worth it. I didn't look like me to me anymore. Well, except for my beard. We talked about what to do about my beard while I was in the makeup chair. It's very recognizable and wouldn't take that keen of an eye to spot me. They didn't have a piece made to go over my chin, so I said, why can't the walker just be me? I was bitten protecting my family, and now there's a Scott Ian zombie walking around. We were probably really overthinking the whole thing, but hey, it's all about the details. And now I had a backstory. I shambled from the makeup trailer over to Walker Boot Camp, where Greg introduced me to a walker named Joe Giles. Joe worked for K&B and was their number one walker. He was one of the first people they tested to be a walker on the show and became their go-to guy for really intense close-up walker action. Joe had that shit down. He asked me to show him my walk. I wasn't nervous about this part. I had been practicing and visualizing this moment since I was 8 years old. I did my walk, slow, jerky, letting extremities hang, leaning where weight would sag to one side, imagining my brain was disconnected from my body, that I had no control over my movements. I even loosened my left shoe so I could bend my foot inward at the ankle, creating the effect of my shoe meeting the ground sideways so it looked like I was walking on a broken ankle. I finished my walker runway walk and anxiously waited for Joe to weigh in. He smiled through his completely torn off cheeks and said, "You got it. Excellent. I have no notes. Triumph. Validation from a zombie expert. I had passed Walker boot camp with decaying colors. I asked Joe what mistakes the Walker extras make on set, and he told me the biggest zombie no-no is the Frankenstein's monster, arms up in front. That'll get you fired from the ranks of the undead immediately. Having graduated Walker school, I was ready for my Walker debut. The set was on an actual street they had closed off in the West Adams area of Los Angeles. West Adams is an old neighborhood by Los Angeles standards. It was one of the first areas developed after people started moving out of the downtown area in the late 1800s. And by people, I mean rich white dudes who built beautiful craftsman houses and awesomely creepy mansions, most of which are still standing. It had the right vibe for shooting horror. I headed down the block to the house where they were shooting the scene and met with Greg. He explained the scene. You'll be walking down the street toward the house. Hannah, the woman that would become the bicycle girl zombie, and her two kids are going to come running out and run right past you. You'll turn and follow them. I could do that. We did three or four takes, and then Greg had me do a few more turns because he wanted to get a good close-up shot of my face. I could have shot the scene all day long. I would have done anything. Bite someone, get torn in half, or rip someone's guts out and eat them. I was committed. Even the contact lenses weren't bothering me anymore as long as they put drops in my eyes every 15 minutes. Already an old pro, I asked if I could keep the makeup on and hang out and watch the rest of the shoot. A camera team was filming me for my field report, so they were fine with being able to get more content of me on set. I watched Joe shoot his scene. He surprises Hannah, biting her arm after she gets in a car she is hoping to use to get herself and children to safety. Hannah shoots Joe in the head and runs out of the car. It was so cool. I hoped that someday I'd get to do a scene where I got shot in the head. Or worse. I got worse. I hung around another hour watching them shoot. During one shot, Greg yelled, "More blood! I need more blood!" I loved having a job where people yelled things like that. I talked at the camera about my experience for the field report, and then I was done. Garrett asked if I wanted to come back to the trailer to take the makeup off, and I asked if I could wear it home. I had the idea to have the camera crew follow me home and film me walking into my house, hanging out with my wife, Pearl, and holding my then 2-month-old son, Revel. Just another day in the life of a walker. Greg said if the makeup wasn't bugging me, it was fine with him if I wore the makeup home. They gave me the stuff they used to dissolve all the glue and a couple of tubes of the makeup remover and told me to take a really hot shower to take it all off in there. I got some very strange looks at red lights on my way home. The crew filmed me holding my son, asking him if he wanted to eat guts for dinner. He didn't even blink looking at me. No fear at all. That's my boy. And we got a great picture of the three of us in front of the fireplace that we used as our Christmas card that year. Father of the year, right here. I was so excited to have been a part of the Walking Dead webisodes and could hardly wait for them to air in October before the season 2 premiere. I had already given up on the talk show thing, figuring they cut together the pilot and it was a no-go. I didn't care. If getting made up and being in the webisodes was all I got to do, I was stoked with having been able to have that amazing experience. Then my agent called. The Talking Dead was a go. Wow! Holy crap, that's awesome! They liked what we did? Cool title as well, I excitedly said to my agent. I'm fucking thrilled. My dream job is becoming a reality. I'm going to be on a TV show talking about zombies and get to be a part of that world on the inside. I was so excited that I wasn't paying attention to my agent as she was trying to get my attention. Scott, hold on, listen. There's something I need to tell you. Sorry, I'm just so excited about this. What is it? She got quiet for a few seconds and said, The Talking Dead is a go, but not with you. Huh? Wait, what? Hold on, I don't understand. What do you mean? I nervously replied, my excitement running out of me faster than the flash and a hot pit of anxiety growing in my belly. They're just going with Chris as the host. No field reporter zombie expert. They thought you were great. They're just going a different way with the show. I'm so sorry, she said, trying to let me down easy. I felt like I'd fallen off a cliff onto the sea-battered rocks below.
I mustered up a reply. Okay, no worries. Thanks for telling me. And I hung up. Fuck. I was bummed. But I was already climbing out of the rocks. I still got to be in the webisodes, and the reality of being able to be on a weekly show was not reality. My schedule with Anthrax would never allow for that. I wasn't thinking of that when I was fantasizing about getting paid to talk on television about zombies. And really, I wasn't missing out on anything because who would watch a Walking Dead talk post show? Dateline, New York, New York, October 16th, 2016. Days before the highly anticipated Season 7 premiere of The Walking Dead, AMC announced that the series, the number one show on television among adults 18 to 49 for the past 4 years, had been renewed for an 8th season, premiering in late 2017 and kicking off with the 100th episode of the franchise. All 16 episodes of The Walking Dead Season 8 will be followed by Talking Dead, the live after show hosted by Chris Hardwick, which is the highest-rated talk show on television and number two show on cable behind The Walking Dead. Who indeed? Talking Dead became the highest-rated talk show on television. More people watched Talking Dead than almost all the late-night talk shows, Colbert, Kimmel, Fallon, Myers, and so on, combined. Congratulations to my buddy Chris Hardwick, the king of talk shows. This shows you what I know about programming television. I'll stick to watching it. Okay, back to October 2011. Walking and Talking Dead were starting their takeover of the airwaves. I was on tour for our worship music album, and life moved on. 7 months later, out of the blue, I got an email from Chris Hardwick. Hey man, top secret idea here, but we might be doing a makeup effects show with Fangoria. Essentially, you'd go to someone like Nicotero, for example, or another makeup god, and he'd give you a basic walkthrough of creating specific makeup effects. We may initially shoot 5 and see how they do. We'd obviously work around your schedule. If interested, we could be more official and have our biz people reach out to yours. Just wanted to gauge your interest first. I think you'd be great for this. Hope you're well. Chris Hardwick. This was April 11th, 2012 at 6:25 a.m. I don't know why Chris was up at 6:25 a.m. thinking about me, but I'm happy he was. I immediately replied, telling Chris I was definitely interested, and soon after that, my show Blood and Guts changed to Bloodworks after Chris's Nerdist network stopped working with Fangoria and started working with Legendary to produce the show, was born. Instead of getting to talk about zombies on television, I was going to get to be made up every episode and get killed or maimed in some awesome way by the top effects guys. Chris and the folks at Nerdist introduced me to Jack Bennett, who they got to direct and produce the show, and we hit it off right away. We were nerd mates. Jack brought in a DP named Justin Cruz, another nerd mate, and we were hip deep in gore in no time. Over the course of the show, I've had my head chainsawed in half by Jerry Constantine. I got to bash a zombie's head in with a pipe and run over a zombie's head with a car at the K&B shop with Greg Nicotero. I got turned into a Jewish Jerry Garcia, who in an homage to Candid Camera, takes a guitar off the wall at a guitar shop on Sunset Boulevard, plugs it into an amp, and plays Anthrax and Slayer way too loud to the amazement of the customers and the dismay of the store management before I walk out with the guitar and get chased down the street. Jennifer Aspinall made all that happen. I got a knife through the face by Robert Hall. I was shot, blown up, and taught how to use a flamethrower by Ron Trust. Decapitated by a gorilla? Yep, that was with Tom Woodruff Jr. and Alec Gillis. I had my face ripped off by Larry Bones and my fingers bitten off by a troll with Mike Elizalde. Vincent van Dyke turned me into the devil, who then grants my younger self's wish to be just like Angus by impaling me on a Gibson SG guitar neck the same way Angus Young is on the cover of AC/DC's If You Want Blood album. I was turned into a deep one from Lovecraft's The Shadow Over Innsmouth and Jack the Ripper by the amazing Joel Harlow. Had enough? Hell no. I was disemboweled by that evil little fucker Chucky, thanks to Tony Gardner. I got drunk in the afternoon with Dan Harmon, talking about his stop-motion animation company Starburns that made Anomalisa, and then I got to see a stop-motion miniature of me murder the Easter Bunny.
I spent 2 days with the legendary Rick Baker, who regaled me with amazing stories about his work. Eddie Murphy is one of those actors who loves to get made up, and Rick showed me his incredible paintings. I went to the Game of Thrones set in Belfast, and I got turned into a fucking White Walker by their makeup wizard, Barry Gower. That's a lot of blood and guts, and not even close to all of it. Thank you, gentlemen, for making dying so much fun. Earlier in this tale, I said that becoming a zombie, quote, takes a lot of hard work and disappointment, and ultimately, it's your love for the genre that will allow you to triumph and represent the undead. It had been almost 3 years since the disappointment of not getting on The Talking Dead turned into the delight of making Bloodworks, which came out of my love for the genre. And all of that led up to me asking Greg Nicotero and the Nerdist producers, going through proper channels and asking the network AMC if we could bring our little Bloodworks show down to Atlanta to do an episode with The Walking Dead. Greg had already invited me down to get made up and be a walker, but I wanted more than that. To do an episode of Bloodworks with a show as big as The Walking Dead, well, that would really put us on the map, getting to be a part of the biggest show on television. That was what I wanted. And on August 1st, 2014, they said yes. I was going to be a walker in an episode on the 5th season of The Walking Dead. Jack and I were thrilled. This was a really big deal on so many levels. They were giving us access no other media gets, but we were under strict guidelines. We were not allowed to shoot. AMC had a camera crew to shoot, and then they would supply us the footage. No problem. We were not allowed to post any pictures from set or even talk about what we did until after the episode aired. No problem. We couldn't air our episode until after the episode aired. No problem. There wouldn't be a problem. We would have done anything they asked us to make this happen. This was the show. Doing the webisodes was great, but this was the real deal. Like in baseball, when a minor league player gets drafted up to the majors, he's made it to the show. Greg needed my life cast sent to the K&B shop in Los Angeles so they could start working on my walker. I'd had my head cast twice for episodes of Bloodworks at this point. The first time I had it done, they didn't put enough Vaseline or whatever they used to keep the alginate from sticking to my chest hair. And when they pulled it off, it was like the scene in The 40-Year-Old Virgin when Steve Carell gets his chest waxed. I cry a little just thinking about it. This time around, my walker was going to be sans beard. Scott Ian isn't walking around in Atlanta, so they would need to make a chin appliance to glue over it. Other than that detail, I didn't want to know what they had planned for my walker. I wanted to see it all for the first time in the makeup chair on set. Everything was coming together. The only piece missing was when. It had to be an episode that Greg was directing. He was directing 4 episodes in season 5, and it had to be on a date when I wasn't on tour. With both of our schedules so fluid, it took a lot of juggling and planets aligning to finally nail down October 6th as the shoot date. I couldn't believe this was happening. I received an email of the call sheet the week before the shoot. It made it real in my brain. I was really doing this. I flew to Atlanta the night before the shoot and took a taxi to the hotel where I met my manager Mike, as well as Charlie from the band, who came down with his daughter Mia. They are all huge fans of the show as well, and the opportunity to come to the set was too good to pass up. I tried to get to bed early, as I had a 5:15 a.m. call time, but I was too excited to sleep. I barely got 2 hours, and then was on my way to Senoia, where the Walking Dead sets are. It didn't matter that I hadn't slept. I had so much adrenaline running through me that I was fully amped. I got to the set right on time. It was still dark and was cold, in the low 30s. Security directed me over to where the dressing room trailers were. The set was very quiet. No one was around to ask what to do. Craft Services, catering, were already set up, so I grabbed the largest coffee I could find and waited for someone to come and open up the dressing room trailer. I was with Mike, Charlie, and Mia, all of us standing outside in the dark, freezing and laughing about how glamorous big-time TV is. After about 10 minutes of that, someone from the production came by and said, "You guys must be freezing. I'll open your dressing room. There's heat in there." I wasn't bothered. I would have stood out in the cold all day to get to be a walker. But we all crowded into my little room to get warm, and I figured the whole day was going to be a lot of hurry up and wait. Wrong. There was a knock on the dressing room door, and someone from the costume department brought my bespoke walker wear in for me to try on. I had sent my sizes weeks before. Looking filthy in my zombie best, I was whisked over to the makeup trailer to be transformed. I met Kevin Wozner from K&BFX, and we got right into it. I asked him what he had planned for me, and he pointed to a model of my head with the pieces they had made for my Walker face. It was a full head application, or what they call hero makeup, because there was going to be close-up shots of my face. The details were incredible. The open wounds on my head were beautiful, and the way they had my spine showing through on the back of my neck was so cool. The makeup took 4 hours, which for me flew by. I'm fascinated with the process of transformation by makeup effects as a fan and as a subject, and I find the experience to be deeply satisfying. It's like getting to wear the ultimate Halloween costume. I emerged from the makeup trailer into the now warm and sunny morning a new man, brutally handsome in an undead sort of way. I was taken straight over to the costume department where they added the finishing touches to my clothes, airbrushing the dried blood in all the appropriate places and giving my look an overall aged feel. The attention to detail is really incredible, with the different departments in synergy to create the best the genre has ever seen. And then I was ready for contacts. As you know from my experience on the webisodes, I'm never thrilled about having contacts put in, but in this scenario, I was a pro lens guy. They popped those suckers right in, and there was no grief from me. I was ready for my close-up, Mr. Nicotero. It was a short drive over from base camp to where they were shooting. I headed right over to the set where they were rehearsing the fight choreography of the scene with Andrew Lincoln and Chandler Riggs. I immediately noticed that Andrew had shaved the beard he had in the previous season. A detail like this would be big news in the Walking Dead fan world. Being the nerd I am about the show, I was stoked to have this inside info before anyone else, and of course I was speculating about why he shaved. Nerd! Another cool detail I noticed was every time they'd rehearse the fight, at the end of the scene, Andrew and Chandler would help the actors playing the walkers get up off the ground and ask if they were okay. I noticed this all over the set that day. The walkers were very well taken care of. I thought that was really cool. Andrew later told me that they're always nice to the walkers, that they're all just working together to make a great show, and the people playing the walkers work really hard in tough conditions under all that makeup. Greg came over to me, gave me a hug, and looked me over, his keen eye taking in every detail of my makeup and costume. He thought I looked great, but they just do some touch-ups right before we shot so the makeup looked fresh on camera. Greg introduced me to Andrew and Chandler, and we shook hands and said hello. They were both very cool. Greg went right back to work laying out the scene again. Andrew and Chandler would be fighting the four walkers that came out of the woods, and they will kill three of them quickly. And then Andrew, struggling with the last walker, gets backed up to where I was underneath the pile of garbage. And then I reach out and grab his boot. Andrew pulls away from me, and then I crawl my upper half out of the garbage, reaching for them, but I can't crawl all the way out because my legs are stuck. I keep reaching for them, and Andrew, just about to kill me, defers to Chandler when Chandler asks for the metal pole, and Chandler puts the pole through my head. Greg asked if we were all good with the scene, and we were, so he had us all get into our positions. I had to crawl under this pile of garbage they had built. They had put a piece of carpet on the ground for me to lay on and piled up all this crap, leaving a tunnel-like space I would use to crawl in and out of. I was the Oscar the Grouch Walker. The set guy helping me get into my position told me that he got into the garbage house himself to make sure it was okay. It was just a bit cramped and damp. Oh, and there were spiders. He had felt something on his leg while he was in there, and when he got out, he realized a spider was crawling up his leg inside his pants. I fucking hate spiders. I was already nervous about my scene, and now I had to worry about spiders biting me? I shook it off. Walkers don't have arachnophobia, and it was time for me to get into my garbage lair. I crawled in and got into position with my head down and hands pulled in out of sight. The set guy covered up the space in front of me with more garbage. And Greg peeked in and asked, "Are you okay?" "Hell yeah, never better," I replied. "You look great in there. You're gonna do great," he said, smiling at me. Then Greg gave me direction one last time. "I know it's hard for you to see out from under there, but look for Andrew's leg. And as soon as you see his boot near you, reach out and grab his pants as fast and hard as you can and don't let go. Make him yank his leg out of your hand, cool?" I said to Greg, I got it. Let's do it. I was laying there in that dark, wet, and cold space, singularly focused on what I had to do. My environment helping me get into a weird place in my mind where I could believe I was a walker. I was able to shut out all the nerves and excitement of actually being in this world I'd watched for so many years and just concentrate on the job at hand, to try to eat Rick and Carl. Greg yelled action, and I could hear Rick say, get ready, to Carl, and then I could hear the sounds of them fighting, and I was set, coiled and ready to strike. Rick's leg came into my small field of vision through the garbage, and I thrust forward as fast as I could, grabbing onto his pants and boot as hard as I could. I could feel him yank his leg once, twice, and then on the third try, he ripped his leg out of my grasp. I could feel a hot flash of pain from one of my fingers, but I ignored it. I crawled partway out of the hole and kept reaching and growling at Rick and Carl, my single-minded desire to reach them and satiate my appetite for human flesh. Greg yelled cut, and he walked onto the set, making slight adjustments, giving some direction to Andrew and Chandler. My middle finger on my Rick-grabbing hand was hurting, and I saw that part of my fingernail had been torn off when he pulled his leg away. I was really holding on tight. It was bleeding a bit, and the set guy noticed and asked if I wanted to see the first aid person. No, I'm okay, no worries. And in a terrible John Cleese accent, I said, it's just a flesh wound. Like the Black Knight, I wasn't going to let a tiny little injury mess up my day. Greg came over to me and asked me how I was. Fucking great. Do I get to do it again? I replied, smiling through my walker makeup. He laughed and said, yes, we'll do a few takes, and then you're close up. Great job. Oh, you don't have to make any noise. They'll dub in the walker sounds later. I wanted to do my own growls, though, as making the sounds helped me feel like a walker, but they weren't going to use them, so I just did them much quieter on the next take. We did two more takes of the same thing, and then it was time for me to die. Months earlier, when Greg told me I could be a walker on the show, I asked him if I could bite Carl. Yes, I know. It doesn't happen in the comic. But so what? The show had taken its own path many times, differing from what was done in the comic. Why not let me be the walker that takes him down? I would be a hero to all the undead. That one bite would get me into the Zombie Hall of Fame for sure. Greg just smiled at me as if to say, okay, idiot, like that would ever happen in a million years. And then he said, I'll figure out a good death for you. Greg had me crawl further out of my crap pile and had the visual effects guy come onto the set to tell me what I needed to do to die like a real Walking Dead walker. The plan was for Chandler to slam a steel, it was rubber, pole through my head. To do that, my head would need to be in the exact right position to make the effect line up and look great. The VFX guy had a frame, like a template on his screen, and he could see the shot and was able to position my head perfectly so it would match up with Chandler's strike. It was easy when the guy was telling me, move left, head up a bit, that's it, don't move, you're perfect. I was going to have to physically get back to the exact position he framed on my own. Greg explained how to move my head up toward the pole strike, hold it for a second, and then drop quickly to the ground. He had me practice resetting to the position I was in when I was reaching for Andrew and Chandler. And then while Andrew was giving Chandler the steel pole, I'd get my upper body and head in position for the pole strike. I didn't have any marks to go by, just feel and hope that I'd line my head up with Chandler's hit. The assistant director yelled, quiet on the set! And in that moment, before Greg would yell action, I was shitting my pants. All my nerves came sizzling back, and all I could think of was that I was going to get this move wrong over and over again and would hold up the whole shoot. I felt like my anxiety was showing through my makeup. Scott Ian as the neurotic walker. Had they ever fired a walker mid-scene, I wondered. How the hell was I supposed to get my head in that exact position? I'd never done anything like this before. And then through this whirlpool of stress flooding my brain, I heard Greg yell action, and a switch flipped, and I instantly started growling and clawing at the air in front of me, trying to free myself from my garbage prison so I could get my teeth into some human sushi. Behind my walker facade, I heard Carl say his line, Dad? Asking Rick for the pole so he could dispatch the walker. I watched Rick hand the pole to Carl and made my move into position, hoping for the best. Carl struck downward with the pole, stopping short of my head, and I raised my head upward to meet the pole as directed, holding for a beat and then dropping lifeless. I lay there on the ground as still as I could. I heard someone cheer and then clap from back where Greg watched the scene on a monitor. Greg yelled cut, and I barely raised my head, not wanting to move too much out of position for the next take. The set guy came over to me and asked, "Did you hear that cheer after you got killed?" I quietly said, "Yeah, I did. What's up?" He told me it was the visual effects guy who cheered and clapped because I hit my mark exactly. The set guy said, "That guy never does that." And he smiled at me and said, "Nice work." Greg and the VFX guy came over, and the VFX guy said, "You nailed it. The digital pole is going to line up perfectly with your head. Good work." Greg asked me what I thought, and I was all business. "I'm ready to do it again, whatever you need." Greg said, "You're done. You nailed it. You're dead. I told you I'd give you a good death." Greg helped me up and said, "Good work, buddy. You're a natural." We hugged, and then he went back to work. I stood there for a minute in a daze as everyone on set buzzed around me, doing their thing, getting ready for the next shot. I was ecstatic about being a part of the show and doing a good job, and I was sad to be done. It went by so fast, so much foreplay, and then bang, finished. A production assistant came over and asked if I wanted to go get the makeup taken off, but I still had stuff to do for the Bloodworks episode, so at least I could keep the makeup on for a little while longer. I wasn't ready to let go of my walker. I did some on-camera interview segments for Bloodworks, and then did a photo shoot with Andrew and Chandler. They were both very cool, and it turns out Andrew is a Motorhead fan, so I told him my Lemmy pants full of poo fighting a Nazi drinking story, as told in my book I'm the Man. They both got a kick out of that tale. Greg had a short break after I was done with Andrew and Chandler, and we got to take some pictures and talk for a few minutes. I must have thanked Greg 100 times for making the whole thing happen for me. It was truly one of the coolest experiences of my life, and he's the man who enabled it. Greg had to get back to directing, and I was taken to the catering tent for lunch. I noticed that all the actors playing walkers ate with their makeup on, so I did the same. I was one of them now. I flew home the next day and spent the next few weeks looking at my pictures from the set. Until we got the green light from AMC, we were under strict orders to keep quiet. It was hard for me to not talk about it. I was bursting. I wanted to shout it out in the street. "I got to be a walker on The Walking Dead, motherfuckers!" I'd hear from Greg every few weeks, telling me the scene looked great and that I was going to be very happy. Jack was busy cutting together the Bloodworks episode, so it would be ready for whenever AMC said we could air it. Finally, they did. The Walking Dead would air Season 5, Episode 12, now titled Remember, on March 1st, 2015. I watched the episode with my wife at home and waited nervously for my scene. At 34 minutes and 11 seconds into the show, I made my cable television debut as a walker. The ratings say 14.43 million people watched the episode in the United States, up a million viewers from the week before. You're welcome. The whole scene from when I grab Rick's pants to getting impaled is only 20 seconds, but for me, it's a lifelong dream realized. And Greg gave me a great death. Afterward. Our Bloodworks, The Talking Dead episode quickly became the most watched episode we'd ever done. It was huge. Go check it out at Nerdist.com. On the episode of Talking Dead that aired that night, they showed a picture of my walker in the In Memoriam segment and named it Steel Pole Head Walker. The nerd me loves that I am on the Walking Dead IMDb page for this episode as an, quote, uncredited walker. It's been a little over 2.5 years since I shot my episode of The Walking Dead, and I still get asked almost every day in interviews or by people who recognize me in the street, "What was it like to be on The Walking Dead?" And I always answer, "It was the best ever."
Wow, Scott, that is such a great story.
Thank you.
You are such an amazing storyteller because your enthusiasm just comes through.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't think many people know this about you.
Yeah, probably not, unless I guess if you heard the audiobook of my first book or,
if you've seen me do my talking shows.
Yeah, but like when you're watching, you know, I've watched many seasons of The Walking Dead, and I'm sure I've seen that season. I'm sure I saw season 5, but, you know, I wouldn't have stopped on you. I mean, you know, I wouldn't have known that was you.
I've had some people over the years who don't know me, like either somehow, you know, on the internet or leaving a comment somewhere. Even now, once in a while, someone would be like, I just saw you in an... I like literally was watching The Walking Dead and I thought I recognized you and I had to go and it turns out it's you. Like if you really paying close attention, you look, cause it is a really good close up of me when the pole goes through my head. And oddly enough, even it looks like me,
even with
my beard missing.
Yeah.
It still looks like me to me. I guess even with the contacts, it just has something to do with, you know, I know it's me, so therefore I can't separate that.
Sure.
But people do recognize me in the zombie makeup.
Your heart must have been beating 1,000 miles an hour because there's so much pressure, right?
I just didn't want to be that guy who, you know, I'm Greg's friend and I'm on set and, you know, and then if I start screwing up and then everybody, I mean, there's like 100 people
waiting around on that for set. You to do the right thing.
There's like literally 100 people working on like on that shot right
because
at that moment.
These television shows are like small movies. I mean, this is really like a film.
Yeah.
And so they're shooting for 14 hours for 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, they're not getting a lot out of
it's
every
intense
day.
And I just didn't want to be that guy and have people like, oh God, Greg's friend. Oh, great.
Hey, Greg Nicotero is the man.
He's the best.
Now did you know his cousin is Frank Nicotero, who's a comedian from Pittsburgh, where I'm from. And Frank, like, he headlines all the time at the Laugh Factory.
You know, he's talked about it.
He's such a talent. Oh my gosh. He would adore you. Yeah. And but I've been hearing Frank talk about Greg for 25 years. Right. And I remember when he landed this, you know, Walking Dead, and then what it became.
Yeah. I mean, nobody knew. How could anyone know?
14.4 million people
saw
your
episode. That's not even close to their biggest episodes.
And that was just in the States as well.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's all fabulous. And I think it's so interesting that you have this passion, you know, that stems all the way back to George Romero and the Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead.
Sure.
And then, of course, your love of Kiss.
Right.
Which all sort of kind of goes with this our generation. You're only like a year older than me.
Uh-huh.
We're kind of the same. And I loved Kiss in 7th and 8th grade because my boyfriend, or my so-called boyfriend, he loved Kiss. And the costumes and all of it together just created like this perfect storm of excitement.
Yeah. I mean, there's a, not to plug my book, but I do kind of tell a story in this book about that, about the moment it happened for me as a kid when Kiss basically took over my life for the next 2 years. And I tell that story, and it's not just that specific moment, but it's all about that moment in time of just like New York in 1975 and being in school and, you know, just dealing with older kids who hated Kiss and that kind of just that time, that place and time in my life and in the world, because that doesn't exist anymore. That New York of 1975 doesn't exist anymore.
Right. Because
hasn't for a long time.
Right. And that was probably one of those moments in your childhood where, you know, that impact, it's just something, it's like an epiphany probably when you saw the costume meet the sound.
Well, it was that. And then seeing them live at Madison Square Garden at the end of 1977 and then what that did to me. And then I never
looked
back.
Your head would explode. Yeah.
Because it
was
did.
Just enormous.
It literally exploded.
How about when the Kiss Alive, Kiss Alive 2. And then they came out with those solo albums. Remember that?
Yes.
And on the vinyl was their faces. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. I bought all four the same day they came out, and because I bought all four, the record store had a plastic bag with the four album covers on it that you got only if you bought
all of them.
Four. So I had the plastic bag and everything.
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say Paul Stanley's was the best of the four.
I think Ace Frehley's was. That was Ace's was mine.
Interesting. Paul Stanley had some love songs that I really, you know, was attracted to.
Yeah, and I think probably why for me Ace's overall was just the most Kiss-like in that it was a hard rock record from top to bottom. I like Paul's and I like Gene's too, but Gene had, there was like, you know, Cher was singing on it. And as a kid, I was like, ew.
Yeah.
And then I don't know, I love Peter Criss, but I don't know what was going on that record.
The spaceman.
He was the cat.
No, he was the cat one, right? Because Ace Frehley was the spaceman. Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what. You know,
Peter Chris was the cat.
I probably like Peter's album now. But at whatever I was when that came out, like, you know,
it wasn't the cool one.
14 or 15. No, I didn't understand.
I can remember, like, I can see those album covers like it was yesterday. I mean, that was just so impactful to me.
For sure.
I had a moment happen when I was a teenager, about 14. And somebody explained to me, because I was starting to fall in love with Neil Young, because my older brother loved Neil Young. And somebody explained to me that Neil had this album out where on one side he did Hey Hey My My, the electric version. And on the other side, he did My My Hey Hey, the acoustic version.
Right.
And I remember that was one of my moments where my head exploded, like, you can do that?
Yeah, you could do whatever you want. Who cares?
I know, but you know, because I grew up in Pittsburgh, you're in Queens. I'm just saying, you know, you were in this kind of a middle America scenario in terms of like what's making an impact, especially at our age, before the internet, and what was coming in and what you were seeing.
Right. Yeah, we hardly had anything. Think about
it. Shit, man. We had nothing.
We had nothing. You had some rock magazines that came out once a month.
Right.
You know, whether it be Cream or Circus or Rock Scene, you had mags like that, that by the time they were out, everything was already old news.
Everything was elusive.
Because everything that was written in that magazine was written 3 months before the magazine came out. Like, it was sometimes a DJ, if you'd listen to whatever the rock station was in your city, sometimes the DJ would have some random information, maybe about the band coming to play a concert when tickets were going sale, but we didn't know anything back then about anyone or anything that was going on. There was no way to know anything. That's why, you know, the whole mystique, a Kiss couldn't happen now.
Right.
There would be a picture of them without makeup on the internet in 1 hour.
Right. I remember thinking, do they wear that makeup when they're not playing?
Right.
You know, do they always wear it? And then, of course, they came out with that song, Christine 16, which had my name in it.
Right.
So my head almost fucking exploded right there. Now, I heard later that Gene Simmons, and even now, I guess, you know, with Family Jewels and that show he did, that he is kind of an asshole.
Not to me.
All right.
I love Gene Simmons. So I've never had that experience personally.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear that.
So, I can't speak for that at all. I love the man.
Good. I'm glad to hear that, especially because he would be an idol, of course, of yours.
Yes.
From childhood.
Known him since 1987, and he's never been anything but kind and a gentleman. And he's gone out of his way for me when he certainly doesn't have to.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Does he still have that Tongue magazine?
I don't think so.
Yeah, because he's done a lot. He has ventured out into a lot. And so you, and I know we're going to wrap this up in a second. We could talk forever. But you really do have a knack for public speaking and storytelling. Did you hear me earlier talking about like that rock star versus comedian or kind of how they're sort of similar?
Sure. Yes and no, because I don't write jokes. And that's the big difference. That I don't understand, it would be the most impossible thing in the world to sit down and write jokes. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
That's not in my brain. I'm sure I could probably work at it and spend a whole bunch of time to be really bad at it. And that's not something I plan on doing at this point in my life.
Right, right, right.
But I do know how to tell a story.
And that kind of...
I know how to write stories. And not even just write stories, because in my talking shows... Not all the stories I tell when I do this live have been written down. I'm telling them off the top of my head. And I just know how to tell a story. I know how to get a reaction. I know how to squeeze every ounce of energy out of words and out of sentences. And I know how to use dynamics. Which, you are
a true artist, really. It's the same things that you're saying. It sounds like that you do in music.
Well, it is, and I just think that's why I know how to do it, and it's not something I ever practiced. I think it just comes out of years and years of writing lyrics and understanding the dynamics of lyrics and phrasing in music, and then also talking to crowds.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're a band, I don't like when bands talk unless, you know, maybe there's a few guys out there that I feel like they have something to say, or they're really funny. And I want the Ramones. I want bands to get on stage and play their songs.
Right.
I want AC/DC. Just get up on stage and play your songs.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear you pontificate about anything. And I agree with that. And we've always been that kind of a band. We just get up there and bang, bang, bang. We play our songs. Once in a while, Joey will say something, or maybe I'll say something. But man, I'll keep it real short and sweet.
Yeah, yeah.
So learning how to do something in 30 seconds and grab someone's attention in that quick and then say what you want to say and then boom, into a song and have them remember what you said, you know, that takes a certain skill set. And
it's huge skill set.
You learn that by doing it for 30 years.
Yeah, and it's confidence and it's brevity and it's...
Yeah, it's actually feeling like the people here actually give a shit about what I have to say.
Absolutely.
Actually believing they give a shit. Whether or not they do doesn't matter. You have to believe they give a shit.
Yeah, absolutely. You are a great representation of confidence and, you know, for your son to see what you're doing and, you know, what you're showing him and other kids, I think you're a great inspiration.
I would actually say that's the key to any type of public speaking is, and I've said it before, I'm a weirdo in that I'm not afraid of public speaking. I know some people say that's even more than death. It's their biggest fear, having to speak in public. Even at like a family member's wedding or something, they can't even get up and make a speech without shitting themselves. And I actually really enjoy it.
But I
crave the moment of being on stage with a microphone.
But I think what's curious about you and what makes you interesting is you don't see that in a lot of rock gods, as it were. Because you're kind of like a rock god first, and now you're translating. Because sometimes the rock and roll guy... That's the only way he can get his point across is through his music and his...
Of course. Not every... No.
You, there's a, so you have
there's
a whole
a few
other
guys
skill set.
I know that are really good at it. And someone who just started doing it, oddly enough, and I've been saying for years, is Bruce Dickinson from Maiden. I've always said for years he would be great. He should go tell stories. He's a great, great speaker. And he just wrote a book, and I think he's going to do, you know, talking shows and... Or he should do talking shows anyway.
Would you ever consider taking a break from Anthrax to grab some of these fellow musicians that are friends of yours and go on a storytelling circuit, as it were?
I've talked about it with a couple of people, and we even have a really good name for it, which I'm not going to say now because until it happens.
Heavy story.
But metal
stories.
Yeah, I've there is a small crew of us that we've talked about it, and you know, it comes down to like just like
I'm in,
all
man.
The time.
I'd see it in a minute.
Scheduling is always the problem.
Yeah,
but I am gonna do more talking shows. I think I might do another UK tour in April of 18. I might do shows there again, and then eventually more shows in the States as well.
You know, I know we gotta wrap it up, but one more thing: you have obviously traveled the world. You are well traveled. When you go to these cities, are there any cities that stick out in your mind where you think like, "Shit, man, I gotta come back here with Pearl, and I gotta come back here. This is fantastic."
Well, yeah, Pearl and I have, you know, she's been traveling longer than I have, you know, with her family and upbringing, and so we kind of just know our favorite places. And
can you just tell me a few of your favorite places?
Paris would be our favorite.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not like a big surprise. Paris rules. There's a feeling I get in that city that I don't have anywhere else on the planet. I love Italy. I love the cities in Italy. I love the country in Italy. Completely different than Paris. Completely different
vibe.
Completely
different, yeah.
But to just be in Italy and be a lazy fuck and drink wine and eat and
beautiful.
Not do anything. I can't really do that in a lot of places because I find that my brain immediately goes into work mode. But in Italy, I could turn myself off.
That's beautiful.
I don't turn myself off in Paris. In Paris, the shit I want to do. In Italy, I don't want to do anything. I'm not going there to look at ruins. I'm literally going to sit on a porch and drink wine.
That's beautiful,
and
man.
And breathe. Yeah. That's what I do in Italy.
And overlook the Duarte.
And it's not like I'm doing this all the time. Like, I've done it once or twice in my life, and I hope to get one of these days when, like, I retire, and then people, whatever happened to Scott Ian, and, like, Pearl and Revel and I will be living in the middle of nowhere in Italy somewhere drinking wine.
You are a hard worker, man. You don't stop. You are a hell of a hard worker.
Thank you.
And a great inspiration.
I know.
Thank you so much for sharing this story. It's really a lot of fun.
Cheers.
Thank you. And I got to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank everybody over at Wondery Media, including Hernan Lopez and everybody on the Wondery team. And a big thank you to my sponsors today on the show. Remember, you guys, please support my sponsors, because when you do, then they like pay me and then I can bring you more stories. That's how that all works. And join us next week for comedian and actor John Flynn.
Before I got this job, I thought... I was a big sort of musical theater queen in high school and college, but like I realized, I knew nothing. Like compared to these guys, you know, these guys were experts.
Don't miss comedian John Flynn next week on Storyworthy. All right, you guys, on behalf of the incredibly talented Scott Ian, thank you again so much. Thank
you. You're welcome. Thank you.
My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.